believe what goes around comes around. The next time you see somebody down, just smile at them. Just say hello and be friendly toward them. And you'll see that what you send out is what comes back. Now, that law of the universe is so powerful that it affects every cell in your body. Every cell in your body. When you look at one cell in your body, ask yourself, what makes the cell work? What makes a cell in your body work? Do you know what makes one individual little cell work? Harmony and cooperation. That's how cells work. An individual cell. If what's inside that cell, the electrons, the neutrons, and the protons, and all that physics stuff that's inside one, if any of them get out of whack and start not cooperating or not working in harmony, what happens to the cells around it? They're affected in some way, aren't they? What is cancer but cells gone amok? When one individual cell is affected in a negative way, that is, when it loses its harmony, when it loses its cooperation, then it affects negatively those cells around it. And those cells around it. And if you look at a blow-up of a cancer cell, you will see that it is no longer cooperating, but it's like the white cells are dominating and trying to eat up the other cells, and that's the disease, all right? And that spreads to another cell and to another cell. And before long, the harmony within you is, you know, physiologically, is destroyed. There's two kinds of energy, supposedly, in every cell. One is the physics energy. Shirley MacLaine talks about this in her wonderful book, Out on a Limb. I recommend you read it. She talks about the physics of what is energy within one cell. And then that there's another kind of energy within a cell that scientists and physicists and chemists, none of us can figure out what it is, but it is what makes the whole thing work. They just call it the source. And that source, the nearest they can get to is love, or cooperation, or harmony, what we call love, which is just love. It's just cooperating and being in harmony with. All right? That's what love is. And that is what makes every single cell work. And when one doesn't work right, it affects the other cells. Now, for a minute, just for a minute, think of yourself as a cell, just as one big cell, okay? Now, one of us as a cell goes out of whack, goes amok, doesn't work right in some way. Does it affect those around us? One cell gone wrong can affect all the other cells around us. It's just a growth process, seeing bigger and bigger cells. But when you think about the entire size of our universe, which is endless, which we can't even begin to comprehend what endless means and uncaused causes and so on, then you are as big as one of those tiny little cells inside of you. And if you go amok in some way, then you affect those around you. And if our planet, which is just another cell, in billions and billions and billions of other cells, if our whole planet goes amok, that is, if we store up enough weapons and we do enough killing and we have enough hate, and as a people we do that, then we will not only affect everything down to that tiny little cell, but all the cells in our planet, in our universe, and it will go on forever. See, I have taken to sending out ICUS, a copy of my parable. I send these books out to all influential people in the world in every field. Just the last 2 weeks, I think our mailing lists have totaled over 4,000 at my own expense, just signing them and sending them out to all the government leaders, all the medical leaders, all education leaders, all people in celebrities, data, all the people associated with different religions and so on. I'm just sending them out. All right? Now, many times when you send things out in the mail to a large mailing list, you get some back. Karma. Understanding how our universe works. In every single obstacle that you run into in your life, there's an opportunity. Every obstacle you have is a hidden opportunity. And seeing it, rather than as something to complain about or call your lawyer about or get upset about or get depressed about or get cancer over or anything in between, you see there is an opportunity in every setback you have in life, including everything you're suffering from right now. Everything, whatever it may be. There's an opportunity in it. Look for the opportunity. Look for the fulfillment, the potential for finding out what you're made out of, rather than for finding out how well you can say, see, I told you things weren't going to work out for me, which is what neurotics do. So in sending out these books, I'll get 100 back. You send out 4,000, you get 100 back. That's a good day. Okay? Only 100 came back. Now, most people who send things out free and get some back say, well, this isn't working. I'm getting these back. I get 100 back and all that. To me, it's like, how can I find that person? That's a test. To me, that's a test from the universe to say, what are you made of? You're just going to give up and not find that person? Or are you going to go look for that person? Because that's to find out what you're made out of. And that's what I do with all of that and have always done. And somehow just knew to do that. When it's somebody says no, it's how can I figure out a way to go around that no? Rather than I think that they're right, I'll just give up. It's always how can I get around that? Well, we sent out a book to Ken Kise Jr. Okay, Ken Kise Jr. wrote a wonderful book called Handbook to Higher Consciousness back in the early 1970s. Now, Ken Kise, I sent him a copy of ICUS to this address that I had on an old book, and it came back. So I sent it to another book that I had of his 8 years later, and it came back. Right? Now I had two envelopes. I had this book in two envelopes. So I finally went to the bookstore and got his newest book, which is called A Conscious Person's Guide to Relationships, I believe, and sent it to that address out in Oregon. So after three tries, I sent it to him. And his wife, Penny, wrote back, and they were in Florida vacationing about a month or two later, and they called us, and they said, we'd like to get together with you. Thank you for sending ICUS. It's a beautiful book, and blah, 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 and it was very nice. Now, I got to tell you that Ken Kise, Jr., who wrote The Conscious Person's Guide to Relationships, and perhaps the most powerful book about just raising our own consciousness as a human species, called The Handbook to Higher Consciousness, does not have a body, so to speak. He does not have a body. It's hard to explain what it's like. He got out of the Navy in 1946, and he was on Miami Beach, and it was in February during the polio season. And suddenly he said, he described it to me, as if somebody had taken gasoline and poured it down his spine and lit a flame to it. That was how intense the heat was. And he was paralyzed from here down for the rest of his life. He's now, I think, 64. And he has been in a wheelchair since then with no power from here down. Every meal that he has to be fed. Every meal. He holds his mouth up like this and they put the food in and he kind of massages it and makes it go down. And he has to be turned two or three times a night because he can't stay in the same position. And he has the feeling, but he has no muscle control, which is what polio is. He has feeling, but no power. Right? Now, here's a man who has lived in this body, which doesn't function, doesn't work, and is writing about optimal health. And so on. Now, he's written several other books, but the one I want to tell you about is called The Hundredth Monkey. The Hundredth Monkey is a philosophy based upon the writing of a man named Rupert Sheldrake. Rupert Sheldrake lives in England, and he has written a book which I have been studying, and long before I read Ken Kise and met Ken, our evening together was just exquisite. Wasn't it? It was just magnificent. It was so powerful to have a man sitting next to me in my car, and I drove him to one of my favorite restaurants, a Thai restaurant out in Pompano, and we had to strap him in, and his legs were just sort of hanging there, and it was almost like a marionette next to me. And as I looked at this man who smiled all the time and was genuinely, authentically, beautifully, blissfully happy in this body that doesn't work hardly at all, it was just astounding. Well, back to Rupert Sheldrake. Rupert Sheldrake wrote a book called A New Science of Life, and it was voted by the American Academy of Physics as the book most likely to be burned by their academy. All right? Because it is so blasphemous and absurd and silly, the notions inside of it. What Rupert Sheldrake is suggesting is that memory, which is what we can recall of all the things that have happened to us, is simply not stored in the brain. It's just not stored in the brain. All kinds of physical evidence to, like where they do experiments with cutting out pieces of the brain, a lot of ways of scientific evidence of establishing this belief. Just let it in. Don't endorse it, just let it in. Don't bite off my finger. Just look to where it's pointing for a few minutes, okay? The notion is that if memory, of course, is not stored in our brain, then where is it? Right? The philosophy is very simple, that all members of a species are connected together through what they call morphogenetic fields, just very much like magnets. And these fields surround all human beings. The Hundredth Monkey is the number, the 100th monkey. Off the coast of Japan, there's an island. And they took a group of these monkeys from one species, and they put sweet potatoes out there on the beach. And they watched the monkeys. And the monkeys began to wash the sweet potatoes in a certain way that was peculiar to this species. And they began to eat them in a way that was peculiar to this species. After a given amount of time, when a certain number of monkeys within that species began to do that, the same behavior began to crop up in monkeys of the same species on islands 200 and 300 miles away. Question is, how did it happen? How could that have happened? And that's, without going into all the details of that, if there is truth that all members of a species are connected, that all human beings are connected as well. And if all of us are connected in some way that we don't understand, but in fact are connected, then I'm not here to tell you that you have to be thinking positive thoughts because it'll improve your life. I'm here to tell you that you have an obligation because you could be depressing somebody in Uruguay right now by thinking negative thoughts. It's true. Now just think about it. Just let it in. The highest form of ignorance is to reject something you know nothing about. That's the highest form you can get to. We know so little about this whole idea. But what we do know is that when human beings begin to think in positive, healthy ways, that they reduce certain endorphins into the chemistry of your blood. This is from Anatomy of an Illness, Norman Cousins. And that when you think positive, happy, loving, laughing thoughts, there's a different chemistry that goes into your body than when you think depressing, negative, anguishing, despairing thoughts. And that thinking the way that you decide to think has a dramatic effect on your chemistry and on your physiology and on your health as a human being. And that we know that when they did the artificial heart transplants, when they were looking for all the people up in Kentucky, who they were going to pick, there were many, many volunteers because a lot of these people only have a few weeks left to live. So if they could get a few more months, they were very willing to be experimented. The number one criteria was the will to live. What kind of an attitude does this human being have? How do they think? Because we do not want somebody who gives up on life, who is going to feel bad, who is going to be telling himself that he shouldn't be in this position. So as you begin to think about the possibility, here's what Ken Kies did in The 100th Monkey. He said, and The 100th Monkey is about nothing I've said so far. That's just all what I learned through my own research and my own reading and so on. The 100th Monkey is a book about nuclear war. The belief is this. If enough people on our planet think there's going to be a nuclear holocaust and believe that it's going to happen, we are going to create it by the way that we think. When a critical mass, and that's the theory, the 100th monkey, when you get to a certain number of people thinking anything, then it begins to spread to the rest of us all over our planet, and we begin to act upon those collective thoughts. The thinking is, who knows, I'm open to it, that we are not only connected to everybody who's alive, but everybody who ever has been, and everybody who ever will be. That we may all in some way be connected. So that if we want, the number one thing in the Hunger Project is that we are trying to raise the consciousness of the world, to help people to understand that starvation is something we cannot tolerate any longer. We won't have it. We won't think of it as something that is inevitable. What is happening now is people are beginning to say, what can I do? How can I change that? The same thing is true with nuclear war. If you want to think about raising your children, my friends, what more important parental task do you have than to make sure that our world is a place that's going to be inhabitable for our children and our grandchildren? Do you know that when I talk to my young children and ask them what concerns them the most, do you know what it is? It's nuclear war. It's what's going to happen to us when the bombs go off. If enough of us think that, we're going to make the bombs go off. Do you understand that's what's behind building more and more and more missiles? Because we begin to act on the images that we have. And so what The 100th Monkey is about is trying to help people to think that it's impossible. We must never have that. We can't even begin to imagine having something like that. Absolutely not. We will not think in terms of bombs going off. And if enough of us do it, and enough of us tell other people about it, and then, in fact, as Victor Hugo said, there is nothing more powerful than an idea whose time has come. And we can make any idea have its time come by collectively thinking in these ways. And imagine that we're all connected like this. Imagine.
We have to get rid of the idea that we're separate from one another.
Yeah. This business about the Russians versus the Americans and the women versus the men and the blacks versus the white, and we don't see the similarities. We don't see that if one of us is suffering any place on this planet, then a part of all of us is. The only difference between all one and alone is just one L. A good example of that is watching my mother with my grandmother. My wonderful grandmother, who was almost 96 years old, was dying, and my mother was taking care of her. And she would go in there with a banana, and she would pull the peel down, and she would mush the banana up in her hands or in her mouth, like a mother does to her baby, and she would feed it to her mother, and she would cradle her in her arms, and she would take her underwear, which when you get very old and you're getting close to the end of your life, you kind of forget about your hygiene habits. She was always extremely clean, but toward the end of her life, she just lost interest in that, and my mother would take her clothes, her soiled clothes and underwear, and wash them and help her put them back on again. And she would hold her in her arms and put food into her mouth and massage her neck to make the food go down. And I looked at her, and my mother was 68, I believe, at the time, and my grandmother was 95. And I looked at them and said, who is mother and who is child? Which one is which? And wasn't it just an instant ago in time, if there is such a thing, wasn't it just that much time ago that it was reversed? That the one who is now the baby was the mother holding the other one and putting bananas into her mouth and cleaning her underwear and changing her diapers and all of that. And it really brought home the essence of we are all one. And time is just sort of our way of defining what happens in sequence in life. But it doesn't have any meaning. I mean, there's really no time in the world. There's only just the world the way it is. And each of us must accept that if any one of us have any suffering going on, then all of us are a part of that. And that's our responsibility. See, you can't get this transformation that I'm talking about in 1 year or 10 years. The wonderful Chinese proverb said that if you want to think a year ahead, sow a seed. If you want to think 10 years ahead, plant a tree. And if you think 100 years ahead or more, educate the people. Once we educate the people and raise a few generations of people who won't be soldiers and who won't kill and who do love and who do see all of us as one and who understand that a person in Japan who is unemployed as an auto worker is just as much of a human problem as a person in Detroit, even though our proximity dictates that we are more compassionate toward the person in Detroit, that's just because we can't think globally. We're only thinking locally. And that it's still any human being who is unemployed is a problem for all of us. And any child who is starving because they're in Africa, a continent and an ocean away, doesn't mean it any less affects all of us.
A lot of people operate under the assumption that I give my love to people who deserve it. And that's a mistake, isn't it?
Everyone deserves it. Everyone. Gandhi said, hate the sin, love the sinner. And that's a very important line, very important philosophical approach to life. Hate the sin, love the sinner. The things that people do are things that we can help them to correct and to change and within ourselves and other people and so on. And we can teach them and help them to grow to not be destructive. But everybody deserves our love. And until we start thinking that way, we're going to always have dichotomies. We're going to always have you versus me, us versus them. And as long as there's that usness and me-ness and you-ness, there will never be a all of us together. See, what we need to do is all go up in a spaceship and look down at the Earth and see this fragile little planet that we live on, and that we are all one on this planet, and that we must all recognize that instead of looking for all the things that separate us, instead of building more weapons to destroy us, We must begin looking for ways that we can all get along. And as hokey as it sounds, if we don't do it, we won't survive it as a species, or it'll be left to generations billions of years from now who can evolve past the Holocaust that we'll create to learn the essential messages of all great religious leaders, all great spiritual people, all great philosophers, that we are love and that we are the essence of what makes this whole thing work is all within us. And the truth won't be revealed to any of us until we recognize that we're a part of that truth. We're all a part of it, and we're all one.